The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we're going to be talking archaeology and lost civilizations in South America with Jerry Wills of Expeditions TV. Are you with us, Jerry?
Yeah, hi, folks. I'm here.
All right. And do you want to, let's get your website out there right away. That's Expeditions TV with just no E at the beginning. Correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's Expeditions, it's plural, .tv.
Okay, and you have a lot of stuff. You actually use Vimeo, which made me kind of happy. I really like Vimeo over YouTube.
But yeah, you know, me too. And we had in the past, we had a much different website. Our friend John Shooter in Spain at Coastal Computing completely redesigned our website, did an extraordinary job, and he suggested Vimeo. So I gave it, John is brilliant, so I gave it a try, and it is all and more from what he said. So it's just exceptional.
We use Vimeo and YouTube, but I think Vimeo quality and just the way you can set it up as a presentation looks so much more professional. And I think YouTube, like the functionality, the way it's set up, I never liked it.
Well, I know YouTube is YouTube. What can I say? serves a good purpose.
Sure, certainly.
For us, we were wanting to have really high quality because we want to do high quality. Everything we shoot, we try to shoot in HD. We pay attention to as many details as we can possibly think of to pay attention to. And when we figured out about Vimeo that we can actually get the detail to attention that we wanted with that, and the quality was up there, it was a no-brainer. John was absolutely right. Once again, John Shooter saved the day for Expeditions TV, our remarkable friend in Spain.
And that is, people can watch all the videos you have up for free.
Yeah, they can. And there's a reason why we did it this way. you see, we started out, oh lordy, it's probably back 2006. What we wanted to do is we wanted to have a TV show. It just seemed like the normal thing, right? And had gone to Peru, had been going to Peru actually for a number of years, a couple of decades. Had a lot of pictures, a lot of slides, had a lot of stories. And usually when we take people on tours to Peru, we would also take time, Kathy and I, and we would go investigate places, look into rumored places that the locals would tell us about. And as a result, we found some really interesting sites that when we get back, we'd tell people about it, and they'd say, well, don't you have a video camera? I said, yeah, I do. So next time we took a video camera. Hadn't really thought about doing anything big, but that first time, that show's called Pupar. The first time we edited it down, everybody loved it, said, geez, you really need to do this. You should be on TV. And that's where we got the idea, huh, it'd be kind of cool to have a TV show. So we got a hold of Discovery and Nat Geo. Didn't go any farther than that. Both of them said, oh, yeah, well, shoot some video and send it to us. You know, show us what 8 or 9 episodes look like. It's like, well, that's a daunting task. How long is an episode? You know, anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes. I said, all right, I'll see what I can do. I'll get back to you in a year. So a year later, we had some episodes up there. And the ones online are in chronological order as we shot them. Well, we tried to get a hold of these guys, and they wouldn't even return our calls. finally, somebody from one of those networks said, you know, we can't even talk to you about this. You're going to have an agent, and you know, they laid it all out. And then if you really want to have a TV show, you're going to have a company that has the cameras that meet our standards and production quality that meets our standards, and they named all this stuff off. And it's like, well, gee whiz, it's Kathy and I doing this. We don't have a $30,000 camera. We don't have $25,000 lens. We don't have the stuff that you're talking about. So, all right, well, it's been nice talking to you, click. So I thought, okay, well, tell with that idea, I'll just make my own darn TV show. So we did. And it debuted, I think it was in 2006. And we've been adding to it ever since. Our philosophy for it being free is that this is fun stuff. And it's also educational. And it answers questions that some people might have about what's out there. And it'd be easy enough to charge. And we'd thought about it because it isn't cheap to do this. But we thought, you know, if we can share knowledge with folks, then there's going to be a payback somewhere. There'll be something good that'll come back to us. And perhaps it's an altruistic idea, but and perhaps even naive. But we did it anyway. And we've enjoyed doing it. So we just continue doing it. Now, with the new website, we have a whole litany of things that we're about to unveil that our devoted fan base has just been waiting patiently for. What we've done to try and recoup some of the expenses, we have said, okay, well, would you like to be a member? And what does that mean? Well, basically it means you're a member. You get to go into a member section. John helped us. Well, John didn't help. He set that up. And if you're going to be a member, well, here's what we're going to give you. Instead of us sending you a DVD, like if you wanted to have a DVD, you know, they'd order it, $20, they get a DVD. Mm-hmm. Or if they wanted some of the sound recordings, you know, I have 3 or 4 different audio recordings we're selling for 10 or 15, I don't recall which. The whole shoot and match, you know, you've got 14 episodes on there, so that's $280. If you want all of them, plus there's a bunch of shorts that we include within the other DVDs. So I said, okay, look, if you want to be a member, how about $25 a year? Hmm. And that'll help to offset some of our costs. It's not making us any money, big time, really. But for that, I'm going to put the files up there. So if you want to download the files where you can burn your own DVD, that's cool. Here's the artwork. Here's the file. Go ahead. Burn your own DVD. Print your own label. If you want to download it so it's like for Apple TV, that's cool. It's there. You can do that. So we're putting a lot of these different files up there in the next couple of months. And it'll be such that, you know, you get value for your membership. I mean, $25 is nothing really for what you're getting, but
not for a year, no.
But it's something, you know, it's some fun. And who knows? I mean, geez, if 1,000 people wanted to be members, it's $25,000. That's going to fund the next trip. We just got back from Peru and Bolivia. That was about I'm guessing somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 to $25,000 expense. But we shot some extraordinary video. We made some amazing discoveries, and those are new episodes that are going to be going up and join the other 14 that are up there right now.
Is there anything you can tell us about those?
Oh, sure. It's pretty amazing, actually. Let's see. The first part of this has to do with a place called Tocachi. Well, Tocachi is in north central Peru. It's on the eastern slope of the Andes. It is an area that historically has been pretty dangerous for anybody to go into. Kathy and I went in there 13 years ago, almost 14 now. And at that time, it was more dangerous than it is now, because this is a place where the Shining Path had their strongholds. And it's also a place where the narco traffickers were growing huge mountainsides of coca and poppies and marijuana and whatever. And, you know, narco traffickers aren't a very friendly lot to outsiders. And, of course, the Shining Path, they're not very friendly to anybody. But I suppose they had some kind of arrangement between themselves and the narco traffickers, planes coming in and out of Colombia and all that jazz. It was a pretty scary place. A person from the outside might go in there and never be seen again. Hmm. But we got information sent to us by someone who frequented that area, who's a native. And there were some great big boulders with these designs on them that no one could quite figure out. Archaeologists said it was just jungle graffiti. It doesn't mean anything. We had those photos for probably a week, and at the end of a week, Kathy said, I've got to go see these in person. I think I have it figured out. I think I know what it means, but I need to get there and see it. So we contacted this fellow, and he was a bit reticent, but he said, well, I'll go ask them and see if they'll let you come in. Got a call back about 2 weeks later. He says, yeah, they said you can come in. I vouched for you. So we go to Lima, our friends in Lima that we always use for our transportation needs. It's Peru Mystical Tours. They're our land company there, and if you're doing tours, you have a land company in Peru that you're working through. Well, they're just wringing their hands. They're so worried. They don't want us to go at all, because this is some really serious business. They're from Peru, and they won't go there. They're afraid of this place. And with good reason. I mean, the Shining Path's blowing up buses with nuns and children in it, and shooting people in schools, including kids. I mean, it was pretty awful. Things that we didn't really know much about until after we got there.
Now, what is the Shining Path? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, I'm not that familiar with it, but they're basically rebels, and they wanted to overthrow the government of Peru and turn it into a different, like a communist state.
Ah.
So, you know, their leader, I don't know where he's at. I think he's in prison, but he was a college professor, and he had his generals under him, and there was big fighting between the Shining Path and the Peruvian military. And the Shining Path was like fearless, and the Peruvian military was fearless. So, you know, you have the unstoppable force meeting the immovable object, basically.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah, and we ended up right in the middle of that.
Were you able to avoid most of that type of stuff?
Well, we remained safe.
Okay, good.
Right up to the very end.
That doesn't sound so good.
Well, we managed to get in there. We hiked in about 85 miles. When we got to these stones, they weren't 85 miles up there. But when we got to these stones, Kathy spent about 2 days and ended up determining that it was a map. And it was talking about different settlements that were up this valley. Hmm. And sure enough, there were other stones, excuse me, at the end of other valleys, and they all turned out to be maps, as far as we're concerned. Archaeologists don't agree, but I don't think they went up there to find out. Well, we did. Kathy said there's a large city that way, and as far as these people were concerned, it was a couple days hike in. But for us, it was, well, you multiply anything there times three if you're not from there.
Mm.
We went in about 85 miles and discovered a gigantic lost city. And there was another and another and another. We ended up locating five.
Wow.
One of these cities, You have to understand, this is in north central Peru, one of the richest gold areas of the world, second richest gold area on Earth. One of these cities was built with rocks just full of gold and silver. It didn't mean anything to the builders, but it sure was astonishing to us.
Now, could these have been some of the lost cities of legend that were built out of gold?
You know, it's hard to say. I know the Spanish were looking for these things, for the gold. Maybe, you know, but I don't know. The thing is that when you hear about the seven cities of Cibola or, you know, El Dorado or any of these places, it makes it sound like they refined the gold out, they made bricks of gold, built a city out of bricks of gold, blah, blah, blah. I don't think it was like that. They certainly knew how to use gold, and they knew how to bring it to a pure form. They made jewelry and blankets and all kinds of things out of gold. So maybe there is a place like this, but I don't know. You know, these places that we found, there wasn't like every block of stone in this large city had a vein of gold in it. It wasn't like that, but there was gold flakes in some, gold veins in others. It was, and of course, this city was in really bad, you know, condition. It was, who knows, 1,000 years old or older. The jungle had started taking it over. We wandered around walls and climbed up on top of walls, and landfills had pushed part of it away, or landslides, rather, not landfills. And the landslides had filled in some of the rooms. And so, you know, we saw things that were just extraordinary for us.
Now, have archaeologists ever looked at this stuff?
No, they never have gone up there because it's still dangerous.
Hmm. Okay.
We found out when we got out of there, we had to be helicoptered up with the military.
Hmm.
I had been on the back of a horse that rolled over the top of me. The horse fell off the cliff and went down about 2,000 feet, and I landed upside down in a tree, and it dislocated my hip.
Oh, man.
So I got rescued out of the tree and proceeded to continue on. It was quite painful, but
I bet.
Anyway, long story short about that is, you know, I couldn't walk out of there. There's just no way I could have. And we finally got word to the military, and they finally sent one of those gigantic Sikorsky helicopters, came flying in, and 50 caliber machine guns out the tail and one of the sides, and machine gun guys out, come racing out of it, and they quickly grab our things, throw it in a helicopter, it takes off, and we're gone. And it took us, 6 days to get there, but it only took us about 50 minutes to fly back to Tekachi, and they eventually took us on to Tango Maria, which was another, maybe an hour away by air.
Wow. Well, you're lucky you landed in the tree.
Yeah, I am, because it was a long damn drop down to the river.
Yeah.
The scale of this place is difficult for people to get their mind around. When you go to the Grand Canyon, for example, you take a look and you're looking down and, you know, it's like a mile down, I think. When you're in the Andes, you don't have scalloped edges going down. You just have straight down. It's like broken shards of glass with trees growing on it. It's that severe. And you look down and you're looking down through clouds, and this gigantic river that you crossed a couple days ago is about the size of a line on a paper.
Wow. How high up were these cities?
These cities were, let's see, the first one that we got to was about 10,000 feet.
Hmm.
And the others were above that. They were above the tree line. Those were the very, very old ones.
Any indication of who might have made them?
Well, you know, I mean, science says that they are Chechapoya. They're the cloud people. They have a lot of cute names for them. Cloud people, eyebrow of the jungle. And then they're very descriptive names. Chechapoya is kind of a fun thing to roll off your tongue. But the truth is, Chechapoya means, you know, fair-skinned, blue-eyed people. Hmm. They don't know who they were. These people that built these cities were... you're looking for that cat? It's out there outside, just to the left of that door. Sorry.
That's all right.
We just moved in, so Kathy was looking for something. Chechapoya people were tall. They were, you know, the 6.5 foot tall range. They had blonde to red hair, green eyes, blue eyes, fair skinned, were quite masterful with working with stone, highly intelligent, very skilled, seemed to possess a lot of knowledge about the stars, about planting, about animal husbandry, all of this stuff. They were very, very evolved people, and they lived high up in these places. Well, they don't know who they were, and Kathy and I have been looking now, researching this for 15 years, and we finally figured out who they are. And now it's just a question of putting the pieces together appropriately. We figured it out. We think we figured it out anyway to within a 99% degree of accuracy on this last trip. And it's based on a lot of research that Kathy did, and also a lot of information from Sally Tudor, who is John's wife. She's just a brilliant lady. Anthropologist. And she pointed Kathy in some directions. She provided a lot of information, and between the two of them, they came up with some information that I think is quite stunning. But, you know, these cities were just left abandoned. They were propagated through the Andes. Considering how fast they could move through the Andes, not us, each city was one day's travel. Start in the morning, you'd get there by end of the day. Hmm. And down there, at that latitude, a day is exactly, what is it, exactly 12 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, give or take a few minutes, but it's always the same because it's right near the equator.
Mm-hmm.
So 12 hours of daylight, 12 hours of darkness, the next city for them would be 12 hours away. And we located five of them, and remarkably enough, there were streets, not in the sense that we have streets in, you know, like our superhighways, but still roadways that connected in many instances. And these were stones that had been cut and placed and put in the ground. And it was a flat, hard surface that even had, edges, like curbs on the side. We ran into a few of these, what's left of them. There's not much left of these anymore. But it was just remarkable to see something that's, you know, 30 foot across, just, of course, trees are growing through it in places and so forth, but where you can actually see what it must have looked like, it certainly would have been extraordinary to have seen in its original condition. Just amazing. These folks were just truly remarkable engineers, very craftful people.
And you didn't actually get to who you think they might have been.
Ah, yes. We believe, well, we know for sure that the Phoenicians had a trade route set up, and they were doing trading with the indigenous people of Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia, and Mexico, and Colombia. And you know that blue dye that the Egyptians so highly prized? The Egyptians were crazy about this blue dye, that they would use it in their robes, they would use it in their paintings, and so forth. It was this particular color of blue that you could only, the Egyptians, you know, they were using it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that comes from aspondagus shells. And aspondagus shells over in the Middle East, they were taken pretty much to extinction. Those clams, they just were taken to the point where there weren't really hardly any, I mean, it's really hard to find them over there. So they found a new supply. The Phoenicians were traders. They traveled all over the world. And they found a new supply off the coast of Ecuador and Peru. So they developed a trade route, came over here, and set up factories where they actually extracted the blue dye out of the aspondagus shells and transported it back to the Middle East, along with other things that there wasn't really any way that anyone on the other side of the world could have had any knowledge of. Things like coca leaves, different birds, different plants. There's just a litany of things that they would bring back with them to trade with. And of course, they brought things with them to trade with the locals at, in the Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a two-way street. And we found proof that this is the case. And the proof is in, I think it's called Santa Maria. Kathy could probably correct me if she were in here, if I'm wrong. But it's in Colombia. There's an area there, it's very much like Tiwanaku with the statues. And there is the defining pieces of information right there in Colombia. Now, what happened for the Phoenicians, they came over here. They set up, large camps, maybe even towns, or perhaps larger than that, cities, where they brought artisans over, and they were building the infrastructure. They had this trade route set up, and they had all this stuff going on. The people they brought with them were coming from their part of the world, of course. They're in Africa. So the next thing you know, there's a volcano that erupts. Well, the Phoenicians, they were navigating by night using the stars. They were the only ones. They knew the secret of navigating by the stars. And when this volcano erupted, it obscured the night sky. And for many years, they weren't able to sail and get to where they had established their trade routes, because it's the only way they knew how to get there. Well, along comes the Romans, as I remember, and the Phoenician army, the Phoenician fleet, really, not army, but the Phoenician fleet, they clash with the Romans, and it turns pretty ugly. And the Phoenicians, of course, they didn't have much money now because they weren't doing as much trading, because they couldn't get their highest dollar prized possession, the blue dye. Well, things just kind of fell apart for them. And the Romans came and overtook them, as I recall, from history. And they were no more. But the people on the other side of the planet, they remembered these guys. And they promised they were coming back. They just hadn't come back yet. And it wasn't until Pizarro and his men showed up, going down to South America, that these folks ever saw white men again. And that's why Pizarro was so welcomed and taken right to the Inca king, because they thought the Phoenicians had returned and they were friends.
Mm.
They were to be trusted. They were traders. They were honest. They took care of business. They never cheated or lied. They did exactly what they said they were going to do. And now here comes Pizarro and his men, and they are the antithesis of all of that. So you can understand how easy it was for the Inca Empire to be overrun by these guys. That's why it was so easy for the the Central American empires to be overrun by these guys, the Phoenicians were trading with them too. That's why they were trusted when they showed up. There wasn't any fighting. There wasn't any doubt that they were okay folks.
Do you think this lends into the legend of Quetzalcoatl and such?
Well, let's talk about Quetzalcoatl for a second. Let's examine what that is. It's the plumed serpent, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is on the flag of the Phoenicians?
With that, I wouldn't know.
Okay. It is the queen palm.
Which is what?
Well, it's a palm tree.
It's a
queen palm. It's a long shaft with a knob at the top and green spray out the top of that. Now, if you're in Central America and you don't know much about the queen palm, because they didn't, but you see this thing looks like a snake body and the snake head and then green plumes coming off of it, because the Quetzal bird had these long green plumes. They take a look at the flag of the Phoenicians, and it's a generalized term, Quetzalcoatl. It's the plumed serpent. Look, they're out there in the harbor. They're coming this way.
Interesting. That would mean some of these interactions, though, aren't that old.
They're not what? I didn't catch that.
That they aren't that old. That they are. That some of these cities and stuff weren't as ancient as they might suspect it to be.
Well, some of them aren't that old. I mean, but in a jungle, you take something that's 800 years old, you're going to be lucky to find anything much of a city at some levels. Hmm. But some of these other places that we found are remarkably old, but they are much, much higher in elevation.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it was safe. It was high and away from predatory animals, from insect and insect-borne diseases. That it was at the perfect altitude where if you take your meat up there, it's going to turn into jerky without you doing anything to it. You take your grain or your corn up there, it's going to be basically not flash frozen, but it's going to be dehydrated to the point where it'll remain good and viable for a decade.
Okay.
So they chose their elevation very carefully, and they lived up there. There was water, you know, and it's at an elevation where, yeah, it gets pretty cold at night, but it gets very nice during the day. There are some places down there that are three stories that have central heating.
Really?
Yeah, and they're thousands of years old.
And how do they do that?
Well, they would have a fire in the bottom, and they had ductwork, and they had it to where it would transfer the smoke out and the heat. Would be the way they designed it, it would bring the heat into each one of the rooms. And it also worked as central cooling if they did it in reverse. If they took the fire out and changed the way the flue was opened, it would suck air in and cool the rooms during the day.
Nice.
Yeah, it's astonishing. These aren't small buildings, these are huge.
You still there?
Yeah.
You're digitizing a bit. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, there you are. Yeah, you kind of dropped out there for a moment. One of the things on your videos that I found very interesting that I don't know if I had heard of before and just forgot or hadn't really heard of is you point out that a lot of these statues in Tiwanaku and as well as in Egypt and stuff all have two left hands.
Yeah, that's an interesting feature, isn't it?
Yeah, any idea what that would mean?
Well, I should know what it means because I researched it. Off the top of my head, I don't recall what it means. It has something to do with godlike powers and I think it was with the god Horus. But, you know, honestly, I don't recall the specifics of that right now. And if Kathy walks back in here, perhaps I can ask her and she can tell us.
Okay. And Kathy actually does all this work with you. She's your wife.
Uh-huh.
And you're on camera more, but she's actually doing a little. She discovers some of the stuff as well, doesn't she?
Well, actually, yeah, exactly. She's more comfortable behind the camera. She's like the human steady cam.
Hmm.
But she has a real good eye for photography, for videography in particular, but photography too. And she is behind the camera, and I'm the stand-up guy, and I'm the talent in front of it. But she is in charge of research and logistics. So when it comes to where are we going, she has all the history, she has all the details, she has all the information that we need. How do we get there? That's the next layer of information that she has. How do we get out? Here's plan A, here's plan B. So she figures all this out. Then we divide up the next task into her area, my area, which my area of expertise is electronics. I was an electronics engineer for most of my life. She is very good at camping and strategy for what you're going to need at the camp. So she covers her end of things. I cover my end. We get together. We go over the notes. We need this. We don't need that. And then we refine it down depending upon what we're doing, how severe or simple the task is going to be. And then she goes and takes care of business, gets the tickets, gets everything booked, and gets everything put in line. I get everything electronics-wise packed. We both do the packing for the camp equipment, if we're using it. And then we take off. And it usually goes flawlessly. It always goes flawlessly. From our perspective, there are always glitches, and when you're dealing with a third world country like Peru or Bolivia, you have to work in days of delays, and that's just part of the territory. It's just, you know, you have to figure that in.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm guessing military extraction wasn't on your plans of getting out of there at any point.
No, it wasn't. You know, we were so naive. I think if we knew then what we know now, we probably would have been pretty shook up about the idea of even going in there. Because when we got extracted out, the military came and got us and to get us out of there because there was a death squad coming to kill us. We didn't know that at the time.
Oh, that's beautiful.
We found out about it a few months later while we were doing another... Well, we were actually living in Peru for about a year in the jungle. And that's how we found out about it. Now, it was a big surprise to us. Well, we were told we were the first white people to ever go in and come back out alive. I don't know if that's true, but that's what we were told. And that kind of gave us a chill as well.
Yeah, I bet. Better to find out about it that way than the death squad showing up.
Well, I had a feeling. You know how you get these weird feelings? Something's just not right.
Well, sure.
And that night before they showed up, I just felt like, ooh, something's not good here. Something's really, really wrong. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't know what it was. It was just a feeling I had. And the next morning, I was like, we've got to get the hell out of here. I just felt like we really needed to go, and sure enough, I mean, here comes, you know, the special forces, and they're extracting us out of there.
Well, good.
Yeah, well, I was relieved.
We're going to take a quick minute break. We'll be back with Jerry Wills in, well, 1 minute.
In 2013, mysteries of the past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Speakers will include Scott Wolter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at ParadigmSymposium.com. Mankind's greatest mysteries brought to the present with new understanding. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at WhereDidTheRoadGo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's WhereDidTheRoadGo.com.
And tonight we've been talking to Jerry Wills, and you there with us, Jerry, still?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, and your website that people can check out all these videos and stuff is Expeditions TV, without the E at the beginning, just starting with the X. And people can go and watch that. How many episodes do you have up?
We have 14 episodes right now.
Okay.
We have two more in the can that we're going to be editing the next couple months.
Nice. All right. What is the oldest site you think you've investigated down in South America?
Huh. That's a good question. Age and dating these places, it's highly subjective. I mean, unless you're educated in the sciences of how to really, really date a place. But from what we know, that's all I can go by, you know, and we're not college graduates, we're not scientists, we're Jerry and Kathy Wills. But from what we know, the oldest place that we've looked at is a place called Pumapunku, which is right next to Tiwanaku in Bolivia, northern Bolivia. And probably the oldest thing that we found yet, the oldest thing we've touched, is possibly 5 million years old.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was that?
A human footprint.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I remember this on your site.
Yeah. I don't know that it's 5 million, but, you know, maybe. I would say it's at least 1.5 million years old, and that's pretty old.
Right. And this is a modern human footprint?
Yeah, it looks just like a human footprint.
Hmm.
The pictures don't really do it justice. You know, it was really, really hard to capture what we had found in photos. I've got really good video of it, and you can see in the video a lot more than you can see in the photos, and that's the part of the video editing that we need to put together. But the footprint looks like a regular human footprint, and it's not the only one in the world. There are footprints in quite a few places in the world, but this is one that Kathy found, and that's why we're particularly proud of this footprint. She found two, actually. One is so obscure looking, it's really hard to call it a footprint, but the other one is quite clear. And it's in a strata of rock that is the scientists say that it could be up to 15 million years old. We don't know how old it is. And the thing that I can't quite get my mind around is when you talk about a footprint in stone and it's in rock that is, let's say it's 15 million year old rock. This is on top of a mountain. So at what point was it not rock? And at what point did a person put their footprint in it? Conditions must have been right for it to be preserved for all this time. But when they say it's 1.5 million years old, I can't quite wrap my mind around, oh, well, the rock's 15 million years old, but the footprint is 1.5 million years old. Well, when was it rock? And when wasn't it rock?
Right.
So, you know, does that make sense to you? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. I can't quite get my mind around how you figure this stuff out. But
well, it would have to be soft enough to imprint a footprint into it. So it couldn't have been rock when someone left a footprint in it.
Yeah, exactly. But if they say this rock is 15 million years old, how old was it when it wasn't rock? Was it 16 million years old and it was just soft?
Right.
I don't know how they figure this stuff out.
I think a lot of it is guesswork, honestly.
I think so. But, you know, people with bigger brains than mine seem to think that it's about 1.5 million years old. However, the techie guys in Bolivia think it's 5 million years old. So, you know, it's anybody's guess. I think it's suffice to say that it's really old.
Yes. And that of course, is at a time where this area shouldn't even have been inhabited, according to modern views of this, correct?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the historical record of how long humans are supposed to have been bipedal on this planet, as with the characteristics of humans as they are now, it doesn't go back 1.5 million years.
It's what, 300,000 or so?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they think that it was, you know, not quite that long, that, you know, 1 million years ago, that they were basically ape men wandering around without any knowledge or any idea. They didn't make carvings on rocks and all this stuff. But that's not true. But anytime you challenge the nature of what's given as the accepted knowledge of archaeology, you go against that, and of course you're a charlatan or worse, a fraud. And if you're an archaeologist, well, you're certainly going to be booted into a different camp where all the people without any respect are going to find themselves. And if you're not an archaeologist, well, you're just an idiot for acting like you know what you're doing. So, yeah, we don't have a lot of respect back towards them either, because they tell us things that are foolish. And they do things to people that are cruel and malicious.
It almost seems childish at times.
It does. And, you know, you have to wonder, what's their agenda? Why is it that they want to have this accepted piece of information broadcast to all the students, to all the professors? Everyone believes this is how it is, and it doesn't waver from that, as though it's a mathematical equation that can only be calculated in one direction, when archaeology is basically not that sure of a science. But there are people who come out and say, I don't think so. Like Michael Cremo, for example.
Right.
And he says, you know, we've got evidence here of 1.2 billion years ago, somebody made this widget. You know, they must have had metallurgy skills to have made this chain that was found in a rock strata that's 1.2 billion years old. So, you know, we don't pay a lot of attention to what the archaeologists say as being doctrine. We just use it basically to to know what they're thinking, so that we know what perhaps to go beyond and not accept.
I think when you look at some of these out of place artifacts that are found in coal veins and rock and such like that, it almost makes you wonder. One of two things has to be happening: either these things are that old, which means that we've lost a huge part of our history, or this stuff isn't forming the way they think it is.
Yeah, exactly. And the evidence that we've seen so far tells us that things do form the way that, you know, science shows that is a predictable manner of formation. So therefore, the other aspect, these things are old and they don't want us to know why. I was talking with Scott Walter from America Unearthed. We did a segment with him on the Grand Canyon. Hmm. I was up there with him last weekend shooting this. And he was saying, you know, I think the church has a lot to do with it. I think that there's some cross-pollination between church and religion and how humankind has progressed in this world in relation to God in heaven and, you know, so on and so forth. Maybe he's got something there. I don't know. But for whatever reason it is, there are some startling pieces of evidence that point to a much, much different version of history than what we've been led to believe. And for some reason, and we don't know what the reason is, but for some reason, that is not supposed to get out to the general population.
Well, I think some of it is probably a simple case of people not wanting to look bad by being proven wrong. They don't want to, you know, have to redo all their textbooks every time, you know, they're proven wrong. You know, they don't want to lose their positions. And, you know, they have a vested interest in keeping the status quo in order to keep their jobs and keep their grants going and such.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the antithesis of science.
Oh, absolutely. I think anytime money gets into stuff, that's exactly what it does. It just kind of creeps through and ruins it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, they call themselves scientists, but they don't accept that there are new pieces of data that surface. They're not really scientists. They're corporate engineers in one fashion or another.
Yeah, that's pretty much dead on. When I was watching your video of Pumapunku, I've seen some of the pictures of some of that stuff, but I don't think it was until I was watching your video that it struck me just how smooth and how machined these things really were.
You know, that's true. And the crazy thing is that when you take a look at this in person, it's just, I mean, you can take a look at it. We live in a high-tech world where you can take a laser and blow a hole through something. You can take a water jet and cut really neat designs into solid steel. You can do all kinds of really dandy things, but you're looking at something that may be 10 to 14,000 years old, and there are characteristics found on these stones that are just impossible to explain. And it isn't that they're just polished. What most people don't realize is that you're taking a piece of granite, and we all know what granite is in one sense or another, but generally speaking, it's just a really hard rock, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you take a piece of granite. If you wanted to polish that piece of granite, and this is what most people don't know, if you wanted to polish that granite has three different elements to it. It has a soft, a medium, and a hard aspect, because this is metamorphic stone. It's igneous in nature. It's been melted, and different silicates are melted together. That's granite. And because of that, you have things that are really hard and things that are really soft that the stone is composed of. So if you try to polish the really soft stuff, you're not going to touch the hard or the medium. If you try to touch the medium, you're going to pit the soft stuff. You're not going to touch the hard stuff at all. And if you try to touch and smooth off the hard stuff, you're going to severely pit the medium and the soft aspects. So there's no way of polishing granite to an absolute mirror-like finish without some form of high technology. And I know there are folks out there that are taking a look. Well, I went to this, I saw a tombstone. It looked like it had a glass finish on it. Yeah, and that's because they have machines that can polish it, and it looks like that. But under a microscope, you're going to see that they didn't polish it absolute. But these stones are polished absolute. Under a microscope, all three are polished equally well. And that's impossible. And yet, it's done. And there's also the aspect of the holes. There's in that video, you'll probably might remember seeing that there was a block there with a whole line of holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those holes are in a groove, as I recall. Now, the groove is absolute. It doesn't waver. It doesn't change. It's just perfect from one end to the other. No variation at all. Those holes are precisely placed. There's no variation from one hole to the next. And the inside of the hole is also polished.
Huh.
How is that possible?
And these, of course, were supposed to be primitives, according to traditional archaeology.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were using copper tools. I mean, that's like saying, yeah, we caught a bunch of parrots, we pulled off their feathers, and we carved some rocks up and made it look real pretty, and we weren't doing anything else, so I guess, you know, why not? Let's build a city, and, you know, it's just that absurd, really. It was, you couldn't do it with parrot feathers any sooner than you could do it with copper.
Right, right. Does archaeology even have much to say about Pumapunku?
Well, they do. They say that they had some pretty skillful artisans that were able to use handheld drills, put it in their palm, basically, and rubbing it back and forth like you're going to make a fire. And they would drill these exquisite holes and make these extraordinary patterns into the stone. Which is goofy, because the only way you're going to do that is with a diamond tip or a laser. You just can't do it with copper. It's impossible. I mean, if you could, my God, I mean, why would anyone, I mean, just that one block of stone, if they were making it with copper, they would have to wear out tons of copper just to make one hole, because copper is not hard.
And it wouldn't end up as smooth and polished as what we're seeing.
No, not at all. And the other thing that's really fascinating about this, and this is where the research I referred to just a little while ago, when I was talking about Sally Tudor and Kathy, mm-hmm, and their research, who were these people? Who were these people that just showed up out of nowhere and built these extraordinary places, whether it's the cities, the Chechapoya cities up in the Andes, or Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, and other sites similarly as extraordinary. And what we're starting to find out is that there were two different groups that were in South America, and were probably there either ahead of the Chechapoya or about the same time as the Chechapoya. And that would be the Vikings and another race, another civilization, perhaps the Trojans from the Middle East.
Hmm.
Because the maps that we've come across and the information that these two extraordinary women have come across, it's starting to point to that very, very clearly.
But even those people don't have the technology to have done some of this stuff.
Well, I don't know, because see, now we're getting into a real gray area of our knowledge. I mean, take a look at some of the stuff in Egypt.
Oh, right, right, yes.
You know, I've seen some of the work over there.
But it seems like the most impressive stuff is also the oldest stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. And this is in the same league as these old places in the Middle East. And it's the same kind of workmanship.
But wouldn't that predate Vikings and such?
Well, I think so. I think it probably would. But what we're looking at is that this was knowledge that, I mean, just because the pyramids and that technology and everything we're talking about that's really, really old Just because it's really, really old, we can trace it back a long, long way, it doesn't mean that the people who came over didn't have an understanding of it. They just brought that understanding with them. They could have been more recent. Now, I don't know that that's the case. I'm speculating. And it's part of what we're trying to figure out, you know? Because there's a lot of speculation about a lot of this stuff. And, you know, having the answers, boy, that would be a lot of fun. Because then we, I guess we would probably sit on it for an hour or two and go, okay, well, that's solved. What's next? But I think that the people, like we're talking about Trojans or whoever, Phoenicians, Vikings, I mean, these people, they were all in existence at the same time. And the ones who came over who possessed this extraordinary stoneworking skill had to have learned it from somewhere and had been using it somewhere. It didn't just suddenly materialize out of thin air. And I don't know for sure, but I don't think that extraterrestrials bequeathed this extraordinary knowledge onto a group of people living in South America and said, hey, you know, here's how you do it. Why don't you go build a city?
Well, is it possible, like a lot of people have speculated, that we're looking at the remains of an Ice Age civilization that was destroyed?
I think so. I think that I think the world is a much different place than what we've been led to believe, and that it was a much different place. There were things going on that we have no idea of, and it very well could be that it was a civilization that existed during the Ice Age or even before. We don't know. The big question for us, of course, that's a big question in itself, isn't it? But another big question, I should say properly, for us, why is there like dozens of meters thick of silt that's over the Altiplano? How is it that there are the bones of sperm whales at 14,000 feet in the deserts of the Atacama in Chile, and dolphins and fish? What is it that occurred? How did this happen? That this place we call Tiwanaku, which is Aymara, it means God is here. How is it this place got to be covered under dozens of meters of silt? It's just mind-blowing.
Well, if you know, I mean, it would take the oceans rising up or the land to have gone from a low level to a high level, it seems like.
Or there's a third possibility. The third possibility is that the Earth just stopped. If you take a look at the ocean off the coast of South America, it's quite large. And if the Earth were to stop the direction of a potential being released is going to be to go towards the east. All that water has a kinetic potential, and it's going to be released, and the Earth might stop. The water isn't going to.
Right.
And if you take a look from the top of South America, right about Ecuador, all the way down to the tip of South America, what you're going to find is that on the western slope of the Andes, there's going to be desert and is going to be a lot of silt. And Kathy found evidence that the Earth actually stopped for 3 days.
Really? And when would this have been?
You know, I don't have that date right in front of me.
Is this perhaps connected to any of Velikovsky's work?
I don't know. Let me ask her. Kathy, is this connected to Velikovsky's work? Come over here and speak up. Okay, it was in the Chinese what? All right. Well, she had a hard drive that died on her several years ago. But there was she had information from one of the dynasties, and I'm sure anyone that could do some research would find this. But there was a battle going on in China during one of the dynasties, and the sun just stopped in the sky.
Yeah, I think Velikovsky talks about this, that he found different cultures around the world actually talk about the sun just stopping in the sky for a period of time.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, she did the digging. She found a record of it. Well, and if that's the case, if the earth stopped as suggested, the water is going, all that potential is going to be released. So the water is going to be flowing towards the east.
Wow. I mean, just I don't think we're capable of imagining that much water displacing.
Well, yeah, I understand. It's mind-boggling, and it's kind of hard to even believe. But when you take a look at the evidence, then it starts becoming a real head-scratcher, because you do find not just one, but it's like a pod of sperm whales. The bones are 14,000 to 15,000 feet in elevation, as I recall. They're sticking out of sand up at the Atacama Desert in Chile. That's just south of Bolivia. There are all kinds of dolphin bones there, fish remains. And at one of these lost cities up the Tocachi Valley, in front of it, which would be to the west, there is a sandbar with seashells in it.
Huh.
And in their stories from the people in the mountains, they talk about the great flood that came washing over the Andes. So when you put all these pieces together, what conclusion you would come to is that, yeah, the earth stopped, the water took off, it went flying across land up into the Andes, and then it receded back, washing everything out to sea that could be washed out to sea. The other things that couldn't be washed out to sea, the huge places like Tiwanaku or Corral, they just get covered up with sand and silt, which is exactly what you find.
Wow. Well, you're on WVBR FM Ithaca. We've been talking to Jerry Wills, and I had about a ton of more stuff I wanted to talk to you about, but we're out of time.
So good heavens.
Maybe I can have you back on at some point in the near future and we can continue about this.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd really enjoy that.
All right. So you, again, Expeditions TV, expeditions.tv, without the E at the beginning. You can watch the videos and check out this stuff as, well, technically you risk your life in some cases exploring these places.
Yeah, especially these last two episodes.
Any idea when those are going to be up? Just in the next few months?
You know, I don't know exactly. I would say, you know, we've got a few things happening, but as soon as these things get done with, yeah, I'd say by October.
Awesome. I can't wait to see some of this stuff. And you have very, very good production values on it. Everything looks great. The sound is good. I mean, occasionally there's a little bit of wind, but you seem to be able to keep that to a minimum as well.
Well, we have wind cutter now, and those are like the dead cat things you put on your microphone.
Yeah, yeah. But even so, enough wind is going to, you know, you can tell when you're stepping out of some of those areas high up there that the wind is just rushing across you.
Yeah, well, sometimes you get in those areas that the wind is really brisk and it's very strong.
All right. Is there anything else people should know about before we go?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm probably going to be doing a tribute to Kevin Smith. If you go to my Facebook page, if you're interested in seeing the program, of course, go to my Facebook page. It's Facebook vimeo.com/expeditions TV. And you can find that information there.
Okay. Kevin, you want to tell people who Kevin Smith was real quick?
Yeah, Kevin Smith was a radio talk show host, number one in the field of paranormal and UFOs. He passed away 2 days ago. He was a very dear friend of mine and Kathy's. I was the associate host for his show, and he asked before his death that we take it over. So now we're kind of faced with... are we going to do that or not? It's a very large undertaking. He usually has around 1 million to 2 million listeners a night.
Wow. All right. Well, and where can people find that?
Well, that's why you need to go to Facebook, because okay. I don't have access to his website, so you would never be able to find the show by going to his website. However, if you go to my Facebook page, the Expeditions TV, then you'll get the information there. Or you can go look up Kevin Smith on Facebook for the Kevin Smith Show, and it'll be posted in there as well.
All right. Well, I thank you, Jerry, and I thank you for all the incredible work you've done, and really looking forward to the new videos, and my condolences on your friend.
Thank you.
And we're going to take Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
All right. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
It has.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays, the whirring of the world? Of the universe, ventricles and tetrahead, chambers number 1597, and counting, and counting.